Iran's foreign minister says Tehran has so far not seen any tangible action on the part of the US and Europe regarding halted talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Tunisia's President Kais Saied has issued a new decree putting in place special measures for wielding legislative and executive power. Also coming up, the U.S. Federal Reserve urges Congress to raise borrowing limits urgently, warning failure to pay government debts will severely damage the economy. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran has so far not seen any tangible action on the part of the US and Europe regarding halted talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark during a meeting with his British counterpart, Liz Truss, on the sidelines of this week's UN General Assembly in New York. He said the US, with Europe's silence and abetting, continues to impose sanctions on Iran while claiming to return to the agreement. The top Iranian diplomat described the US position as a clear contradiction. He added that the reconstruction of ties between Iran and Britain requires adopting serious measures, stressing that London needs to repay its four-decade-long debt to Iran. Amir Abdullahian also met a number of other foreign diplomats at his first appearance at the General Assembly. And Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations has criticized the recently announced security pact between the US, the UK and Australia. Kazem Gharibabadi says London and Washington have imperiled the nuclear non-proliferation treaty and the principle of nuclear disarmament by pledging to provide Australia with atomic-powered submarines. He called on the two countries to drop their double standards and stop jeopardizing their non-proliferation commitments under the guise of strategic concerns. Gharibabadi said the US and Britain condemn Iran for enriching uranium at 60% purity, while the submarines they plan to build for Australia would use reactor fuel enriched at more than 90%. He said Canberra must allow safeguards, inspections of all nuclear materials by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Gharibabadi said the IAEA must keep the Board of Governors consistently informed on the matter. Earlier we asked the author and journalist Daniel Lazar about what he thinks regarding the AUKUS security pact between the US, the UK and Australia.
I mean, the U.S. has pursued a monstrous double standard throughout this period. You know, it says nothing about the hundreds of nuclear weapons that that Israel possesses. You know, but makes a regards any progress that Iran makes towards even enriching uranium as profoundly unsettling to the Middle East. And the same thing goes for Australia. I mean, giving nuclear technology of the sort to Australia certainly changes the balance of power in the Western Pacific, and it clearly points to the very good possibility that Australia itself might one day acquire nuclear weapons capability. So the U.S. is just pursuing, you know, two different lines of logic. There's one rule for Iran and other countries like that, and another rule for America's allies.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has failed to make inroads in landing a major post-Brexit free trade deal worth tens of billions of pounds with the US after what seemed like a successful trip to the White House to meet with President Joe Biden. Critics point to Britain's exit from the EU and the shaky Northern Ireland Protocol as the main sticking point. Amina Taylor has more from the British capital.
It was the usual glad handing and bon ami for the cameras, but after a 90-minute discussion and photo op, there would have been very little of substance for Boris Johnson to claim as marquee victories for his administration. It was the reluctance of President Joe Biden to guarantee the coveted free trade agreement worth nearly £300 billion a year with London that would have been the most bitter pill to swallow. Britain's exit from the EU and the fallout from the shaky Northern Ireland Protocol has been cited as a major sticking point, though President Biden attempted to downplay the link.
There are two separate issues. On the deal with the UK, that's continued to be discussed. But on the protocols, I feel very strongly about those.
Johnson tried to shrug off suggestions the prospect of a deal were disappearing.
The Biden administration is not doing free trade deals around the world right now, but I've got absolutely every confidence that a great deal is there to be done.
Analysts across the Atlantic are certain both issues are intrinsically linked, but crucially, it also undermines Johnson's Brexit credentials.
A trade deal in the United States is very important for Boris Johnson. That's what he was more or less promising when Britain left the European Union. That's what he was dangling in front of us, that everything was going to be okay. Britain would be an international player signing these trade deals and this and that. The one with America was the most important, and he's not got it. And it puts the relationship between Britain and the United States, the so-called special relationship, in perspective.
It would have been a political triumph for Prime Minister Boris Johnson, returning from a successful visit to the White House and brandishing on the floor of the House the details of a free trade agreement with Washington worth hundreds of billions of pounds. Now Johnson finds himself playing the waiting game and hoping against hope that his EU strategy pays off. Boris Johnson will head back to face his ministers to perhaps sell the idea of the UK joining the existing trade deal that's already up and running between the US, Canada, and Mexico. But for many inside government, and indeed the wider Conservative Party, it may well feel like a backward step. Amina Taylor, London.
Tunisia's President Kais Saied has issued a new decree putting in place special measures for wielding legislative and executive power. The presidency made the announcement in a statement but did not elaborate on the new measures. It also said that Saied will form a committee to prepare amendments needed for political reforms. It added that he will also maintain the suspension of the country's parliament. Meanwhile, the leader of Tunisia's Ennahda party called the president's decision unacceptable, saying that is meant to cancel the constitution. Saied sacked the prime minister and suspended the parliament on July 25th. Opposition members accused the president of a coup. Saied rejected the accusation, arguing that his intervention was needed to save the country from corruption and political paralysis. Political commentator Sami Hamdi says Tunisia's president is seeking to cement one-man rule in the country.
What we're seeing today is the official coup, rather than the sort of steps that were taken beforehand where people were debating whether it's a coup or not. Today we're seeing absolute authority now in the hands of one man, executive, legislative, and judicial authority. We're seeing now the suspension of parliament. It's no longer a state of institutions, and Saied will rule as he wishes, conduct reforms as he wishes, without any of the consensus or democratic means that the Arab Spring worked so hard to achieve. The reality is now the army will wait and see what the reaction is. If the reaction of the streets is one of denouncement, one that tells Kais Saied, we reject this coup, and if the numbers are bigger than the ones that were there last week in which there were big protests against Kais Saied's coup, it's likely the army will go to Kais Saied and tell him, stop, please step aside, I don't want any chaos unfolding. But if the people do not take to the streets, then the army will go along with it. Because for the army, it's important to remember that Kais Saied's announcements did not come in a vacuum. It came in the midst of this popular resentment towards parliament, popular resentment towards the political elite, towards the establishment that people blame for not delivering on the aspirations of the Arab Spring since 2011. So Kais Saied's moves did not come from a vacuum. And the reality is there are many people who support Kais Saied's measures.
The chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve has warned that failure to pay government debts would do severe damage to the economy. Jerome Powell called on U.S. lawmakers to raise the nation's borrowing limits urgently. He also warned that the Federal Reserve or anyone else cannot protect the markets or the economy in the event of a failure by the government to repay its debts. However, the opposition leader in the Senate has steadfastly refused to cooperate with the majority holding Democrats to increase the debt ceiling. Officials have warned that it could lead to chaos in financial markets. Colin Campbell explained the possible consequences should Congress fail to raise the debt ceiling.
But right now, because we are in such polarized political times, you have Republicans who refuse to help Democrats and authorize the debt ceiling raise. Now, we've seen what happens before when it comes to the U.S. defaulting and not raising the debt ceiling. We've seen our credit rating go down. We've seen national parks close. We've seen outrage coming from some members of the public, some politicians. But altogether, the debt ceiling is usually raised. It's usually part of just what politicians are supposed to be doing. But right now, things are very partisan. Republicans want Democrats to take all the blame for raising the debt ceiling so that they can use it as political fodder in upcoming elections, saying, see, look how much Democrats are spending. They're spending all the money. They're tax and spend liberals. This is costing you taxpayers more money in the end. That's why you need to vote them out of office. It goes on and on and on. Many people expect that the debt ceiling will be raised, and right now it'll be incumbent upon the Democrats to handle this responsibility solely because Republicans will not give them the assist.
Bipartisan talks that is in the United States Senate for a police reforms bill have broken down without a deal. Democratic Senator Cory Booker, who has been leading talks with the Republicans, said the deal is out of reach now. President Joe Biden accused the Republicans of rejecting even modest reforms. The bill was passed in the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives in March. The reforms, dubbed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, were proposed following the death of the African-American man at the hands of a white Minneapolis officer last year. The law would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. Floyd's death triggered nationwide protests against police brutality and racism in America. In Indian-administered Kashmir's Srinagar city, the centuries-old tradition of extracting rose water continues. The legacy has been carried forward by a lone family for four centuries. However, it may become extinct soon. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
In the downtown area of Kashmir's capital city, Srinagar, lies the centuries of traditions and legacy that came to Kashmir via Silk Road from Central Asia. This part of the main city, Srinagar, remains untouched by modernization. Set up on the banks of River Jhelum, the downtown Srinagar is home to many scholars who came to Kashmir along with their disciples to preach Islam. Some seven centuries ago, Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani came from Iran along with scores of artisans, preachers, scent makers and traditional healers. These men settled around the banks of River Jhelum and taught their specialities to the locals. And to date, these teachings are the source of survival for tens of thousands of people in Srinagar. Let's meet probably the last scent maker of Kashmir, Azizullah Kosgar. Few steps away from the shrine of Shah Hamdan or Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani, this is an Arkigulab Dukan or rosewater shop. It is a major attraction for tourists and the younger generation. The 65-year-old Kosgar's shop is filled with centuries-old jars, some empty and a few partly filled. Kosgar is the last remaining rosewater maker. This shop carries 400 years of Kashmir's legacy.
For Muslims, rose water has a spiritual as well as religious significance. This shop was set in 1820, and these glass bottle jars and decanters were imported from different parts of the world. We have a collection of other fragrances besides rose water. We have been making herbal medicines, but now people prefer modern science instead of traditional methods.
The Kosgar family has been in the trade for distilling rose water for four centuries, and the entire process is done manually. His customers, however, can't do without his handmade fragrances and herbal syrups.
We have been living here for centuries, and we know the worth of his pure rose water and other products. Besides that, his herbal syrups and ointments have been healing our ailments, whether related to skin or immunity. We use his rose water during special occasions and during the holy month of Ramadan to make special drinks.
Kosgar's rose water is made specifically from Kashmiri roses and has been used for centuries to perfume shrines and mosques, since it is believed to be extracted in the best of its form. Azizullah Kozgar has acquired these skills from his forefathers who had traveled here from Turkey some 500 years ago. He says they have kept the secret method rolling from one generation to another, but he fears whether his son will take it or not and wishes that somebody comes forward and takes the legacy ahead. Kozgar says the political uncertainty, lockdowns and lack of people's interest in pure rose water have resulted in falling demand, and these reasons might sooner or later force the closure of his centuries-old business in Srinagar. Shahanabad, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Elsewhere, tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are facing a barrage of detention and vicious expulsion campaigns since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government, which calls them a security threat. Data by Indian Crime Records Agency shows that Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Manawa Zaman has the details.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India after fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing. They are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threats to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
There is no evidence whatsoever about Rohingyas being involved in anything even close to terrorist activity. This is the paranoia of the Indian deep state, which increasingly wants to do all this fear-mongering to increase its budget.
Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat. Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest and stand by its ethos considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Holy Defense, a Mirror of Ashura. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. The Holy Defense Week has arrived again. This week starts on September 22nd, marking the beginning of invasion and occupation of Iran's soil by the Iraqi army under the former Iraqi ruler, Saddam Hussein, an imposition of the eight-year war. The holy defense of the Iranian nation against the invading army of Saddam was a manifestation of the eternal epic of Ashura and the unmatched uprising of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Stay tuned, please, for the first episode of a special series on the issue. The eight-year war that Saddam imposed on Iran at the behest of his masters in Washington in 1980s is known as the Holy Defense in Iran. Although war is a reminder of destruction and death, it becomes sacred and beautiful when it becomes an arena for manifestation of lofty human values. The eight-year Holy Defense against the Ba'athist army is such a war. The youth, men and women, who sacrificed their lives in this way are the examples of resistance and steadfastness whose memory will never be forgotten. The eight-year war began on September 22, 1980, with the full support and help of the West and the East, but the two blocks of power didn't achieve their wishes of disintegrating Iran and destroying the Islamic Republic system. This war turned into a strong point and honor for the Islamic Revolution and the point of growth and flourishing for Iran. More than 250,000 of its best Iranian youth were martyred and tens of thousands of others became invalid in the war. The Iranian people proved that they had taken the example of Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura to stand firmly on their beliefs and values against the invasion of the global arrogance through its stooge, Saddam. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had said earlier, "The Islamic Revolution of Iran is a gleam of Ashura and its great divine revolution. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the day of Ashura, "Look how much blessing this half a day has had in our history, and it has been alive and inspiring till this day. It is not just to be read and retell to enjoy people or impress them. It is rather the source of blessings and movement. This has been tangible in the revolution, the war, and our past history. In the history of Shiism, and rather the history of the anti-oppression revolutions in Islam, even by non-Shias, the event of Karbala has been brightly and conspicuously impressive. Perhaps it has been impressive in non-Islamic environments. In our own history, that is, the past 1,300 or 1,400 years, the very half-a-day event has been effective. Thus, it is nor strange and far-fetched. If we don't want to compare our 8-year war with that 8 to 9 hours of Imam Hussein's Ashura, or not consider it brighter than that, which this is the reality, I mean, I don't know any event in history which can be compared with that half a day. Everything is smaller than that, but this war is a scheme of that, or a drop of that sea, after all." Dear listeners, the lessons of Ashura have always been enlivening, moving, and inspiring. Although this event took place in a special place and time, its lessons are not limited to a certain time and place. Seeking of justice and freedom, struggle against oppression, tyranny and corruption are the outstanding lessons of Ashura. The first step in Imam Hussein's struggle is fearlessness. Superiority in number and military equipment should not cause fear, as this was fully manifested by Imam Hussein and his companions. Imam Hussein never feared the enemy's awe. The Iranian combatants during the 8-year holy defense too rushed to help the Hussein of the time, Imam Khomeini, without fearing the awe and propaganda of the enemy. They marched in the footsteps of Imam Hussein and his loyal companions with full trust in God. The Iranian combatants never capitulated to the calls of submission and preferred dignified death to life in humility. The young Iranian combatants knew it well that what could make them victorious over the enemy was their faith and trust in God and a steadfastness and unity among themselves. Martyr Mustafa Chamran beautifully depicts this in his supplication with Imam Hussein, peace upon him, when he says, "My master, I have come to fight with you against unfaith and oppression. I have come with all my being. It is Tasua, or 9th of Muharram. A huge group of Yazid's hordes are moving with a lot of tanks, cannons, armored vehicles, and many soldiers. Right and wrong have faced each other. The enemy is advancing rapidly, and I want to fight like one of your companions in Karbala." Iraq had dispatched 9 divisions to the war against Iran, and in practice, It enjoyed 12 armored, mechanized, and infantry divisions and 30 independent infantry brigades. Iraq's combat power was 8 times more than Iran. Yet, some estimates believe that it was 15 times stronger than Iran. What Saddam had never expected was the valor of Iran's combatants, who were scared of nothing and followed Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The Iranian combatants were the symbols of this part of Ayah 249 of Surah Baqarah, which reads, "How many small party has overcome a larger party by Allah's will? And Allah is with the patient."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady here from IRRB English Radio. In the studio, as always, I have the pleasure and honor of having my lovely sister and friend and wonderful guest, Sister Razia Shamli. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear sister.
We've been discussing the importance of self-care for a Muslim lady while taking the example of the most wonderful example in the history of examples, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and how His Eminence observed every aspect of self-awareness, self-consciousness, mindfulness, taking care of himself, and by doing so, taking care of those in his care, right? Mm-hmm. And as Muslim ladies, when we focus on the life of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we see how important it is, you know, to be aware of our state of being and to be careful of how we are, how we look, how we feel, how we're functioning. So, Sister, as you've been sharing with us so far, of I think we're up to tip number 5, principles and
tips and techniques.
In order to implement self-care into our lives as Muslim women, whether it's time management, whether it's mindfulness and awareness, whether it's
family care,
daytime naps in the middle of the day, applying henna,
right,
for both men and
hair care.
Yes, exactly. Hair care and skincare routine so you can look gorgeous and fabulous. We dropped it at point number 5. You were telling me the 14 benefits.
Yeah.
Of applying henna. The last one was the rage of your foes because you look fabulous.
You know why? Because when you're in the old days when their hair and beard grew gray and white, and like at war times when they appeared in the war front, you know, the enemy would see them as bunch of old folks, and then they would be like, huh, it's a piece of cake too.
Exactly, to just end this creature.
Exactly. But
to
then
slay them.
When they applied henna on, and especially younger. The black one that the Prophet said that God's, you know, this color is most favored in God's presence, they looked really young and fabulous. So
right.
It enraged the foe.
And intimidating, basically.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. And it makes the gum strong. Isn't that interesting?
That is very interesting.
I said the use on for the nostrils, for bad odor, making it good odor, giving it a good odor, reduces Satan's whims. I don't know. I have no explanation whatsoever of how it reduces Satan's whims. It says brings light to the eyes.
Seriously, from this distance, I'm seeing you in a blur. I should apply henna. To where? My eyes? To around my eyes?
I don't know.
My
I
head,
think to your face.
Hair. Okay.
To your face, forehead, cheeks,
interesting.
Chin.
Okay.
It's an adornment.
Mm, definitely.
Right?
Obviously.
It gives a good scent to the mouth. I said that makes the angels happy. That's interesting. It contents the believers. First of all, when you have good self-care of yourself and you smell well, you appear in the society, you look fresh, amazing. Mm. So the believers would become happy.
Exactly.
Right? It's a pleasant smell because it gives your body a good smell. The two angels of Nakir and Munkar, they also feel ashamed to, you know, to question them so much. And they see that, you know, actually, I think it means that someone who adheres so much to the sunnah of the Prophet in the details of life to this extent, definitely in the bigger picture of their lives, they were good people.
Mm.
That's what I understood from it. But it doesn't finish here. I want to also talk about other hair care and skin care points that we can find in the life of the Noble Prophet.
Of course.
And that my reference was the book of Sunan al-Nabi, written by Allama Tabatabai, and they were talking about the third chapter where it talks about rules of beautification and cleanliness. In the old days, not so long ago, when I used to go to my grandma's house in their shower, they always had a bowl of sidr. Sidr is lotus jujube. I read it in the Sunan al-Nabi that the Noble Prophet also washed his hair and beard with sidr, which is a kind of plant that they make. It's very similar to henna, right? And I remember my grandma, she always kept this tradition of cleaning her hair and her body with the sidr. With this amazing herbal plant, right? So it was in the sunnah of the Prophet to hair care.
Right.
How much attention, you know, the Prophet could have simply washed his hair with...
Or he could just shaved it.
Yeah, which some of the Prophets did. But he took great time. He put, you know, in this the three portions that I said, one portion was for himself, probably in that... one portion of, you know, he paid attention to self-care issues, hair care, skin care, right? The other thing that I found very interesting in the sunnah of the Noble Prophet that can definitely come in handy for women, for us Muslim ladies, is that the Prophet used to comb his hair and he would comb it with water. And he would say that water is enough of a perfume for a believer.
So he'd comb his hair while it's a little damp still?
Lifestyle was different back then. Mm. But maybe he damped his hair every time he wanted to comb it. He put some water. You know, water actually hydrates your hair.
Mm.
It's a natural hydration, right? So he combed it with water. I do remember my grandma also doing the same. They had like, you know, they put their comb in water and then they brushed, they combed their hair. The other hair care tip that we can learn from the Holy Prophet was that there is a very beautiful verse in the Noble Quran where it says, put on your adornments on every occasion of prayer. This is in Surah Al-A'raf, verse number 31, right? Now, the Prophet beautifully explains about this hadith and relates it to combing one's hair.
Mm.
He says, you know, the adornment, it's the combing of hair. Because combing hair brings sustenance, improves the hair. It actually improves your hair quality. Hair growth, fulfills the need. I didn't understand what kind of need he was talking about. Increases strength and sexual drive. And it stops phlegm.
Interesting.
So if you have like a weak body, like you feel like always
languid and
wanting
fatigued.
To like lie down somewhere, your phlegm is probably high, and you will combing the hair actually
reduces it.
Right.
We're going to go on a short break, and we're going to be right back, so don't go anywhere. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Muslim Lady, and we are discussing the importance of self-care in Islam and its examples.
You know, Zainab, maybe hundreds of times people have gone through Sunan al-Nabi and they have read these hadith, but to categorize it under the category of self-care, because, you know, Zainab, sometimes we have certain categories in our minds, and we better understand issues when things fall into its own category in our mind.
Definitely.
So when I'm saying to you, when I say to someone, the Prophet combed his hair, but when I say it's a self-care, hair care, it helps your hair growth, because nowadays people are killing themselves to buy so many hair products. Before going to the shower, they, you know, massage their scalp
with oil,
with oils.
Essential oils, yeah.
Then different kinds of shampoos, that
and conditioners and hair masks, and they're all chemical.
Inside
anyway.
Hair mask, outside hair mask, and then serum for the hair. Mm. So many different hair products, so expensive.
Exactly, and they're so really bad for the environment.
Exactly. But then the Prophet took all these procedures to take care of his hair. It just shows how much emphasis that he gave to self-care.
And how sustainable he lived his life.
Exactly. Using natural ingredients, natural herbs, oils. I'm going to talk about the different ones that the Prophet used. So combing was one of the things that was in the tradition of the Noble Prophet. And you know, when you cut your hair, when we cut our hair, we put it in the garbage dustbin, right? So part of the sunnah is that you do not just get rid of your hair, you bury it.
Oh, so it returns to the earth.
Right.
Beautiful.
See? Mother Nature.
Exactly.
Sustainability.
Or you can donate it, you guys. There's this new concept that they donate human hair to cancer patients. They make natural wigs out of it.
Wow.
And I actually looked up the fatwa, and it's halal, and we're allowed to do it, so maybe we should look into that.
But I think it has to be a certain length, right?
Yeah, yep, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing, subhanAllah. So, three things will have to be buried: your hair, your nails, and blood. Even menstrual blood, I read that it was in the sunnah of the Noble Prophet that they buried it. But
then the material they used was different.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Than these days. Also, clipping the nails was of the sunnah of the Noble Prophet. But for women, the Noble Prophet would say that keep your nails a little longer than men so that it increases to the beauty of your hands.
Definitely.
And
beautiful.
The Prophet would tell married women to dye their hair so that they would look prettier for their husbands. And he would say to the single girls to dye their hands with henna so that their hands would look different from a man's hand.
Beautiful.
Right? And don't look at your hands right now where we do the dishes in the dishwasher, we don't wash clothes because we use the washing machine. They had like rough hands.
Laborious lives.
Exactly. They were living in a city where there was the scorching heat. Everything was done manually, making bread,
making flour, cooking, starting fire, washing.
So just imagine how rough the hands of the hands the hands of the lady would become. And then you apply henna, it helps your skin to get smooth, and also it distinguishes a woman from a man.
And I think it acts as a sign too. I mean, you look at the woman's hand and you know that she's not married.
Exactly. That's a good point too.
Thank you so very much, Sister Razia, for all these interesting and practical tips regarding Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam's beauty routine. And inshallah ta'ala, as Muslim women, I hope that we are able to draw inspiration from these matters and implement them into our lives so we can be happier and more fabulous. Until another episode of the show, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, so Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The limelight.
Thanks to Daniel Hale's whistleblowing, we know that U.S. drone warfare frequently kills civilians, and in some cases most or all the victims are civilians. As Hale has said, with drone warfare, sometimes 9 out of 10 people killed are innocent. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Daniel Larrison, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Must Shut Down Drone War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. August 29th U.S. drone strike in Kabul that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, demonstrates the bankruptcy of the war on terror. Like many other drone strikes, the strike in Kabul targeted innocent people and achieved nothing except to blow up civilians that had the misfortune to be in their vicinity. According to 2 recent investigative reports in New York Times and the Washington Post, the vehicle targeted in the strike carried no explosives, and the car's driver was Zamari Ahmadi, an aid worker who had spent the day delivering water to those in need. Hailed as a righteous strike by General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Kabul drone strike was an atrocity that should never have happened. The Biden administration has emphasized that the U.S. possesses over-the-horizon capabilities to continue waging war in Afghanistan even after the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the country. But the August 29th strike shows why the United States should not be using them. The Kabul strike last month received an unusual amount of attention and scrutiny because it happened shortly after the bombing at the airport and because the Biden administration made a point of touting the strike as a success in preventing a second attack. As the subsequent investigations have proven, however, the people killed in the strike had nothing to do with the local ISIS affiliate or any other terrorist organization. Zahmadi's brother Imal told the New York Times, "All of them were innocent. You say he was ISIS, but he worked for the Americans." The military has defended the strike, but all their specific claims fall apart under scrutiny. U.S. officials claim there was a secondary explosion that proves that explosives were present in the car, but according to the investigative reports, no such second explosion occurred. The objects that believed to be explosives were water containers. Despite surveilling Ahmadi for 8 hours that day, they managed to get every important detail wrong about what he was doing, who he was with, and what he was transporting. The killing of these 10 innocent people is an outrage. But the bigger outrage is that this strike is not an outlier. Things like this have been happening in Afghanistan and other countries for years, but they have received little or no attention. When these attacks take place in remote areas, as they often do, it is difficult for investigators and journalists to determine what really happened. Because this strike occurred in a major city, there were lots of witnesses and journalists could piece together the evidence more easily. Who knows how many other innocent people have been targeted in the same way that Zamari Ahmadi was? How many people have been executed like this simply for going about their daily business? Who seriously believes that this has nothing to do with the security of the United States? Daniel Hale's whistleblowing, we know that U.S. drone warfare frequently kills civilians, and in some cases, most or all the victims are civilians. As Hale has said, with drone warfare, sometimes 9 out of 10 people killed are innocent. Many of the people targeted by drone strikes are not necessarily even militants, but just happen to be military-age males. Because the military wrongly assumes that everyone killed in a strike is an enemy combatant, unless proven otherwise, the number of civilians killed by U.S. drone strikes is bound to be considerably higher than the government acknowledges. The U.S. military has made a habit of not counting or undercounting the civilian victims of U.S. air and drone strikes. The U.S.-led bombing campaign in Iraq killed many thousands of civilians, but the military acknowledged only a small number of these. As Matt Kahn and Anand Gopal reported in 2017, we found that 1 in 5 of coalition strikes we identified resulted in civilian death, a rate more than 31 times that acknowledged by the coalition. It is at such a distance from official claims that in terms of civilian death, this may be the least transparent war in recent American history. U.S. strikes in Somalia have killed dozens of civilians, but U.S. AFRICOM has acknowledged only 5. The Kabul strike fits into this pattern. 10 people were killed, but the military owned up to only to killing 3 adults. Drone strikes have served as the background noise of U.S. warfare for the last decade and a half, and as such, they are mostly ignored until they cause enough loss of life to register briefly on the radar of Western media outlets. The drone war has continued across 4 U.S. administrations, and in recent years, the conduct of that war and the casualties that it causes have been increasingly difficult to track. Americans had a clearer view of who the victims of drone strikes really are, more of us would realize that the drone war needs to be shut down. It is not making the U.S. any safer, and even if it were doing so at the margins, it comes at an unacceptably high price in innocent life. No government has the right to do what Americans did to these 10 people in Afghanistan, and there is no justification for continuing a policy that regularly results in such slaughter.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.